James Dobson told a story a few years ago about a friend of his who often flew his own single-engine plane to meetings and appointments. He was flying into a small country airport that had one airstrip, and he arrived late at night, and the sun had already slipped behind the mountain, and it had obscured his visibility to quite a degree. In fact, when he flew into that little airport and he circled looking below, he couldn't see the airstrip. That small country airport had no one on duty. There were no lights on. He wasn't sure what to do, and he circled again, and then he circled again and again, knowing that if he attempted to land, he would probably crash. He didn't even know where the airstrip began and where it ended. He had enough fuel to fly about that airport for 2 hours, and at the end of 2 hours, panic began to grip him, knowing that he might have to attempt a crash landing, assuming he probably would not survive it, and he didn't know really what to do. And then a wonderful thing happened. A man who lived near the airport had heard late into that night the droning of that small engine as it flew around and around and around that small airport. He knew immediately as he listened what was going on, and it awakened him from sleep as he listened, and then he knew he had to help, and so he jumped in his car and he raced to that small airport, and he went to that one airstrip and he drove back and forth with his lights on high beam. And then after driving several times, of course the pilot had noticed this, and then the man parked at the far end of that airstrip, and he, with his high beams, illuminated that small airstrip, and the plane was able to fly in over the car and land safely. As I read that story and my study progressed in 1 Kings, it reminded me of the early days of Solomon's reign and his writings, which provide for us a set of brilliant headlights that show us where to land in this dark, dark world. Now, I know that I address the subject and you're already way ahead of me. We're tempted to speed up this videotape and get to the place where Solomon himself attempts some dangerous things and he himself crashes. I want us to take time to look at this incredible young man in his start when his heart was loyal to God and to the Scriptures. His heart was filled with God-given wisdom. I want us to drink in as much as we can of Solomon's wisdom from those early years. It is for us serving as a brilliant headlamp on this small airstrip of our own private and public world. Now, in our last discussion, his wish had been for wisdom, you remember, and God had granted the wish. Now, the remainder of chapter 3 is really nothing more than an illustration of how wise and discerning Solomon was. So would you take your Bibles, if you haven't already, and turn to the first book of Kings. And we're going to spend a rather dramatic day in court. I want you to turn to chapter 3 and sort of prepare yourself as we'll slip into the back of this courtroom, and we'll listen and watch as this unusual case and undoubtedly a no-win case develops. Verse 16. Then two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And the one woman said, "Oh, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And it happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in the house." In other words, there were no witnesses to this. "And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on it." It evidently suffocated. "So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept and laid him in her bosom, and she laid her dead son in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son whom I had born. Then the other woman said, 'No, for the living one is my son and the dead one is your son.' But the first woman said, 'No, for the dead one is your son and the living one is my son.'" And they thus spoke before the king. The tense tells us that they continually spoke this case before the king. The background of this story is very simple. There are two harlots who give birth to children, both boys, 3 days apart, and they lived in the same apartment. Now this dispute had started out between the two of them, but it escalated quickly and it involved the neighbors. Ultimately, it involved the local magistrates who were unable to make a decision or render a verdict. And then it finally ends at the Supreme Court with the Supreme Court justice, which was the King of Israel, presiding. Now the case is a difficult one to judge. Put yourself in Solomon's sandals for a moment. Evidently, all of the lower courts have been unable to reach a decision. There were no eyewitnesses. The disputants were of the same questionable character. And you know the testimony depends on the character of the witness. Well, they were both rather questionable. It was one harlot's word against another. And not only that, but the testimonies were evenly balanced. One would make a statement and the other would flatly deny it and make the same statement to which the other one would flatly deny it. And both women were passionate in their testimony. It must have been an uproar. You can just imagine with me that scene that day. Here are tempers that are raging. Shouts are going back and forth. There's probably a little tug of war going on with this young boy who's probably screaming at the top of his lungs, and they are saying, "He's mine. No, he's mine. No, he's not. Take your hands off him. He's mine." And they're both passionately pleading and begging the king to see it their way. And young Solomon is standing in the middle of that. If I had been Solomon, my temptation would have been to say, "I didn't ask for this job. You go back to the lower courts. I never went to law school." Verse 23, then the king said, "The one says, 'This is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one.' The other says, 'No, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one.' And the king said, 'Get me a sword.'" Imagine that. So they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, "Divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other." Then the woman, whose child was the living one, spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, "Oh, my Lord, give her the living child and by no means kill him." But the other said, "He shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him." Oops. It's in the Hebrew there. You got to look. Verse 27. Then the king answered and said, "Give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She is his mother." This is an incredible perception into maternal instincts for young Solomon to be aware of. This shocking solution could kill the remaining child, but Solomon, with wisdom and discernment beyond his young years, knew that he could count on the tender love of the true mother. Her concern for the safety of her son would surface and identify her in this scenario. The real mother would be the one who would be willing to give up her son so that he would be able to live. Where did Solomon get that wisdom? There wasn't any doubt in anybody's mind here. Look at verse 28. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king. That is, they reverenced him. For they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. In other words, it was clear that this was a gift from God. Get your pencils ready and let's look at a few phrases here where that's clearly spelled out. Look back at chapter 3, the middle part of verse 12 in 1 Kings. God said, "Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart." Look again at verse 28 and underline the last part. They saw that the wisdom of God was in him. Look at chapter 4, verse 29. Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind. God did. Look over to chapter 5, verse 12. It says, "And the Lord gave wisdom to Solomon, just as he promised him." See, the point is, and it makes it very clear, that you don't learn this discernment from law school. You don't receive wisdom with your engineering degree. When you receive a master's in sociology, you don't get with that discernment and wisdom. That comes from God. Now, the rest of this chapter will inform us that Solomon's wisdom extended beyond the judge's bench. We'll call this wisdom across the board, an incredible thing to notice. Look back at 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29. There are three key words that you ought to circle in your text. Verse 29, it says, now God gave Solomon, first of all, circle the word wisdom, chachma. That can be defined as looking at life from God's point of view. Solomon wrote these words. Listen, the reverence of the Lord is the instruction for wisdom. Now follow this. Wisdom is the ability, he says, to see life from God's perspective. And I know this may sound trite to you, but you've noticed that Solomon said the reverence of God is the manual or the instruction for wisdom, reverencing Him. You know what that means? That means, in its simplest form, that you and I do not need to read the latest Christian bestseller to become wise, although that may help. You and I don't need to trot off to the latest Christian seminar, as helpful as it may be. We don't need to learn the latest Christian technique in devotional living. Solomon says it very simply. If you want wisdom, worship God. If you want a wise and discerning heart, have a relationship with Him. Know Him. And understand His manual that He's given you, which is this book. Get to know God. The second key word in your text is the word discernment, the word binah. You could write in the margin of your Bibles beside that verse the word insight. It concerns the ability to distinguish between truth and error. It helps you decide between that which is valid and that which is invalid, that which is correct and that which is incorrect. If wisdom is seeing life from God's perspective, then discernment is living life with God's perspective. Discernment is the sister of wisdom. It helps you to interpret events correctly. I love this story that was sent into the Reader's Digest. Now, I've had a number of people tell me they appreciate the fact that I don't preach from the Reader's Digest. And I'm not going to hear, but I'm going to illustrate from it, okay? Virginia Spring was a middle-aged housewife, and she's seated with her family in front of the television set, and aunts and uncles and everybody's gathered around in this den, and they're watching the television, and they're focusing in on the arrival of Pope John Paul II. As they watched screen, the Pope, his airplane landed, and he came down his flowing robes down those steps, and then as he walked away from the plane, he ceremoniously knelt, he stooped, and he kissed the ground. And after that, this woman's 80-year-old aunt leaned over and whispered loudly to her, I know just how he feels. I hate to fly too. Well, she misinterpreted the event, and rather funny. But I'll tell you this, when it comes to interpreting the events of our lives, if we misinterpret them, it will not be funny. In fact, it can be tragic. And people do that every day. Wisely interpreting the events of life from God's perspective is a byproduct of wisdom. Now the verse goes on to give us the third key word or phrase. Look at the middle of verse 29. It says, God gave Solomon breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Largeness of mind, literally. This refers to a breadth of interest. He doesn't necessarily give all of us a breadth of interest like he gave Solomon, but he promised to give us wisdom and discernment. But would you notice with me what some of those interests were? Fascinating. Look at verse 33. It says, and Solomon spoke of trees. That is, he's lecturing. He lectured on trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. By the way, this phrase is a categorical expression. Ancient rankings, I have read, place the cedar of Lebanon at the very top and the small hyssop that can grow from a crack in a wall as the very least. So what this is basically saying is that Solomon's botanical interests were all inclusive, from the greatest to the smallest. He was able to lecture on the entire range. Notice further, verse 33, the middle part. He spoke, or he lectured also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Imagine that. One author said this, listen carefully, writing some 150 years ago. Solomon was the founder, the only representative, not merely of Hebrew wisdom, but of Hebrew science. We should understand him to be, among many other things, the first great naturalist of the world in the midst of his kingdom's collection. Now, the reference to Solomon lecturing about these things was more than brute observation. You know, that animal's got four legs and it drinks water and it likes to climb trees or whatever. It was more than that. He is literally implied in the phrase speaking about, he is relating these subjects and correlating them to the Creator God. He's relating his knowledge to God. He's relating the plant and the animal life to the Creator God. And so people would not only develop their awe and understanding of the natural world, but they would develop an awe and understanding of the Creator God. See, to Solomon, these were more than brute facts. It was the relationship of knowing God. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is true wisdom. The problem with our culture today and our scientific and our artistic achievements is that they are not being correlated through the Word, and they are not landing at the feet of a Creator God and His created universe. And so we can develop knowledge, but we miss the correct conclusion. That's why today art can be blasphemous, it can be pornographic, and yet loudly defended as acceptable. That's why today a tree can have equal or greater rights than a landowner. That's why an owl can put hundreds of people out of work. That's why religion today can actually bless cats and dogs. Now don't misunderstand, the world of nature is a wonderful world. We are to be wise and careful stewards of this planet that God has given unto us. But if we learn without ever correlating what we learn through the Scriptures to Creator God, eventually trees will have feelings and dogs will have souls. Am I creating any controversy yet? Relating the created world to the believer is exactly what Jesus Christ did. It's fascinating when you climb up that hill and you listen to Him speaking to the multitude. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus Christ did this very thing. He says, you seem troubled. Have you ever taken a close look at nature? Have you watched the feeding patterns of birds? They don't toil. They don't build barns. The Father provides in giving them instincts. Have you noticed the wild flowers that you're sitting around? And have you recognized the fact that they didn't spin their garments? They didn't paint their petals? Yet God, in His creative ability, did that for them. If He can do that for them, what do you think He can do for you? You see, that is bringing the knowledge and understanding of what we see around us and landing at the feet of a Creator God who is awesome. I like the quote I read recently from Frankie Schaeffer's book, The Son of Francis Schaeffer. This is a point that I think motivated Solomon. This is what he reveled in, and if you are interested in things like him, take this at heart. He says this, if from this world around us we can learn anything about God's character, surely it is that we have a creative God, a God of diversity, a God whose interests in beauty and detail must be unquestioned. Listen to this. We could have lived in an uninteresting, flat world, one that had the bare minimum of gray ingredients to support life, one whose diversity was only enough to provide the minimum of existence. Instead, we live in a riotous explosion of diversity and beauty. We live in a world with thousands of species. We live in a world peopled by individuals of infinite variety, talents, abilities, shapes, and colors. And when one looks heavenward and sees the complexity of the reaches of space above us, the mind boggles at the creativity of our God. Good. Now, the account of Solomon's breadth of mind is astounding. Some of my friends in my study helped me by compiling them. Would you just listen to the list? Solomon was interested, and he evidently studied all of the following. This is just a smattering. It's not comprehensive. Natural history, botany, ornithology, astronomy, geometry, medicine, music, poetry, writing, and architecture. By the way, his architectural feats included building houses and reservoirs and gardens and parks, orchards and vineyards. His crowning achievement was that golden temple that we'll look at. It's amazing to me that a man could be so well versed in so many subjects. I tend to identify with the kid who, you know, did real well in spelling and history, but did really poorly in math and science. Can you identify with that? Now, some of you are the opposite. You're weird, but you did real well in math and science, and you couldn't spell. I love the story of this boy that I could really identify with. He was an elementary student who took a test in anatomy, and he failed it. Man, bless him. Now, this is what the young student had written on his examination. Quote, "The human body is composed of three parts, the brainery, the borax, and the abominable cavity." He's groping for straws here. "The brainery," he went on, "contains the brain." I can believe that. "The borax contains the lungs and the living things. The abominable cavity contains the bowels, of which there are five. A, E, I, O, and U." But I'll bet he was good in spelling, you know. Well, oh, bless that boy's heart. Now, your text goes on in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 30, to tell us that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. By the way, Egypt is known by this time for its wisdom literature. It also tells us that his wisdom exceeded several well-known individuals with strange-sounding names, but men of repute in his day. Ethan the Ezrahite, he appears, by the way, in the title of Psalm 89. Seems that he wrote that particular one. Heman, according to 1 Chronicles 15, was also a musician. The others listed here include men with names like Calcol and Darda, the sons of Mael. We don't know anything about them except that their inclusion means that they were the Pulitzer Prize winners of Solomon's day. They were the Nobel Prize winners. They were the Einsteins. They were the Aristotles. They were the thinkers. They were the brilliant men of Solomon's generation. And the Bible tells us that Solomon surpassed them all. What an unbelievable beginning this man had. What incredible advantage. Verse 32 informs us that he spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. Now that's fascinating because the book of Proverbs only contains 800 of those 3,000. Wouldn't you like to have the other 2,000 to read? Well, God preserve for us not everything that Solomon wrote, but enough to adequately equip us for life. But what I want to do is follow some of the clues that this wise king laid down for us under the inspiring influence of the Holy Spirit. How do we find discernment? Because I'm basically addressing a congregation and myself that I know do not ask the question, do I need wisdom? But the question we're asking is, how do we get it? Where do we find it? We can't afford to live without it, right? Well, I'll tell you ahead of time. Finding wisdom is a matter of heart. In the book of Proverbs, some 80 times, Solomon references the heart. Now let's do a little theological digging. Gerhard Kittel, a gentleman who wrote a massive scholarly series that takes about 3 feet of my library, did a study on the Greek language and through the Old Testament and New Testament thinking. He said this of the word cardia, translated heart, that the cardia, which we get our words like cardiology from, in the Old and New Testament mind, the heart occupied the main function of spiritual life. Follow this. The place in human beings at which God bears witness to himself. That's how the Old Testament and New Testament minds considered cardia. The heart was the dwelling place for feelings, emotions, desires, and passions. It was the biblical seat of understanding. It was the source of thought and reflection. It was the seat of the will and the source of decision-making. We believe that. We have sayings in our culture like, sow a thought and you reap what? An act. Sow an act, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap your character. You sow your character and you reap deeper destiny. Solomon said it best, as a man thinks in his heart, so he is, so he acts, so he becomes. Now in Solomon's Proverbs, he alludes to the heart 80 sometimes, and we can find our heart in this list, crafty, righteous, the cunning heart, the glad heart, reverent heart, hopeless heart, cheerful, proud, teachable, haughty, deceptive, pure, the grieving heart, the envious heart, contented hearts and angry hearts, the sensual heart, understanding heart, the surrendered heart, the joyful heart. See, the question is, what makes the difference in what kind of heart we have? Well, as we begin our search, believe it or not, we have to begin with our ears, according to Solomon's clues. Would you look with me at Proverbs here for the remainder of our time? Chapter 12, look at verse 15, as Solomon relates wisdom to listening. Proverbs chapter 12. And you ought to underline with your pencil or your pen the phrases that directly relate getting wisdom to listening. He says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel." Look over to chapter 13, verse 1. "A wise son accepts his father's discipline, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke." Look at chapter 15 and verse 31 and 32. "He whose ear listens to the life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. He who neglects discipline despises himself, but he who listens to reproof acquires understanding." Flip back to chapter 1, the very beginning of this book, and in verse 2, Solomon begins by stating that this collection of proverbs and wise sayings was to do several things. It was to allow us to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the saying of understanding, to receive instruction. That word receive means to welcome warmly, like you would welcome a friend who'd come to your home, who receives, welcomes instruction in wise behavior. All of these verbs, the verbs know, discern, receive, imply that we are not talking. We are listening. A person who becomes wise is a person who somewhere came to the conclusion that he wasn't, and he stopped talking and began to listen and seek out wise counsel. In verse 5 of chapter 1, Solomon continues, "A wise man will what? Hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wisdom." You see, a person here in Solomon's thinking and in the Spirit of God, a wise person is not considered wise because he knows everything. He is considered wise because he wants to keep learning. Now, my dear mother made it real simple for us four boys. Same principle. She must have been reading in this book, but she'd tell us it this way. She'd say, "Boys, you got two ears and one mouth. That implies you ought to listen twice as much as you talk." I used to hate that. But she was right. Since she's listening to this tape, I love her very much. One of Dallas Seminary's well-respected scholars was a professor of Old Testament by the name of Bruce Wolke. He said that if he had one book in all the Bible to choose to help him live, he would choose Proverbs. And if he had to choose one chapter, he would choose chapter 2. Would you turn there with me? Proverbs chapter 2 begins with an invitation to wisdom. Look at verse 1. "My son, if," you ought to circle the word if, "you will receive or welcome my sayings. If," implied, "you will treasure my commandments with you. If," implied, "you will make your ear attentive to wisdom." That is, if you'll listen to me. Look at verse 4. "If you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasure, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom." Did you notice the passion in this person's search? Verse 3,
If you cry for it, verse 4, if you seek, if you search, literally, if you dig out. Do we treat this manual, this instruction book of wisdom, like we do a magazine at the doctor's office? We flip through it, we look for the pictures, and we skim the headlines, and then we wonder why it doesn't make any difference. Oh no, he says, if you want to dig it out, if you want to search, if you cry after, you plead for, if you can't live without it, you'll find it. If you want wisdom, he says, you have to become a wisdom hunter. You have to become a wisdom archaeologist who patiently with a spade turns over soil carefully. And he looks and he watches. Whether or not you're a wise person will depend upon your ability and willingness to dig and to listen. You know, one wise sage wrote it this way. I have often regretted my speech, never my silence. I've often regretted my speech, never my silence. So search for wisdom is a matter of the heart that relies heavily upon the ears. I want to go one step further. The search for wisdom ends with the feet. You see, whether or not you're a wise person will not be revealed in how much you know, but in which way you live and how you walk. Solomon puts it into perspective. Look over at chapter 16, verse 9. He says, the mind of man plans his way. That is, he thinks about it. She carefully considers the path. They plan, they think, they even pray. They are serious about the path of their feet. Now notice the implied submission. Though the mind of man plans his way, he says, the Lord directs his steps. You could refer to this verse as making your plans for life, but giving to God a big eraser and saying, God, I give you the right anytime you want to erase my plans. I put them in pencil. See, I'll plan them, but you ultimately do the directing. This allows him to direct us. Frankly, do we ever need directing with our busy lives? Anybody in here not busy? There's a little 2-year-old raising his hand back there. Getting some more chores, Mom. Just kidding there, fella. Has it ever occurred to you that Jesus Christ was an incredibly busy man? When you look at his 3.5 years of ministry, it was a whirlwind. Jesus Christ was unbelievably busy, but Jesus Christ was never sidetracked. And I want him directing my life, don't you? For those of us here who will hunt for wisdom, I want to encourage you by giving you 3 observations. These are words to the wise, and they come from this source of wisdom. Number 1, having a heart of wisdom is merely a return to the basics. Take a look at your heart. Are your ears open? Is your mouth closed? Take a look at your feet. Where did they take you last week? What did you do? Did you walk among the wise in the way of wisdom? And which way are they pointing this coming week? Where will they take you? See, it's just a return to the basics, isn't it? Secondly, having a heart of wisdom is not inevitable, but it is available. I want to drive that point home again. Where do you think that Solomon first learned that wisdom was a matter of heart? You know, you study a passage and you read, and sometimes things just kind of jump out and grab you by the lapels. That happened to me. Where did Solomon first hear and learn that wisdom was a matter of the heart? Words that Solomon had read undoubtedly. Lord, teach us to number our days that we may present to you hearts of wisdom. Now there is a relationship, and he cracks the door and he gives us a little more light on this clue-driven path that we're pursuing to discover wisdom. There was a relationship between understanding the brevity of life and wisdom. Now, I know that sounds morbid, but isn't it true? You ever been in the hospital? You ever been flat on your back? And it's like your eyes opened to perspective in life, and you think, why didn't I know this before? When you and I are hit with our mortality, it's amazing what it does, doesn't it? I know a number of you have been praying for Floyd Green and his wife Diana. I was in their home a couple of weeks ago. He was hit by a drunk driver while he was riding his bicycle. In fact, he and his wife. His wife was brushed by the car, and it hit him head on. He literally crashed head first into the windshield, and the car carried him for some 100 feet before he fell off. For 3.5 hours, Diana told me she didn't know if he was alive or dead. We sat in his den, their den, and talked. He's frail. He's gaining his strength back. And it looks like he'll walk away with hardly more than a little scar or two. But as I sat there listening to them talk about this experience, talk about wisdom. Talk about perspective. And it happens to us too. I want to return you to something that Dr. Wolke did. He took the verse, Psalm 90 verse 12, by the way, and he applied it literally. Dr. Wolke created a calendar and he marked it off backwards, assuming that he would live to the expected 75 years of age. And he created a backward calendar, and every morning he'd rip off a page and it would tell him how many days he had left. So I just got my calculator out and I said, okay, Davey, how many days you got back? Well, I've got, according to my calculations, and I used the calculator, by the way, I have 13,870 days left. It's assuming I live to be the age of 75. Doesn't sound like much, does it? If you're 40, you have roughly 12,000 days left. If you're 50, you have 9,000 days left. Getting a little warm in here. If you're 65, you have roughly 3,600 days left. Whether you have 13,000 or 3,000, it doesn't sound like much, does it? It sort of makes you want to reach for this book of wisdom and hold it closely so that you and I don't waste a day. See, there is a relationship with understanding our mortality on earth and having a heart of wisdom. I want to give you one more word of encouragement to all the wisdom hunters here. Having a heart of wisdom is not developed by what you know, but who you know and who you follow. We're going to wrap it up, but I just want you to listen as I read to you some words from this wise, middle-aged king who has reflected deeply on life, and he has experienced depths of wisdom that you and I are in the process of pursuing. He has a discernment about life that God has promised he will give us if we will ask. For if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and he will give you buckets full. And he will never rebuke you for asking him every single day. I want you to listen to what he wrote and notice how he relates wisdom with not what he knew, but with whom he knew. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice. He preserves the way of his godly ones. Then you will discern righteousness and justice and equity and every good course. For wisdom will enter your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will guard you and understanding will watch over you. Let's go hunting, huh? Just remember that the hunt begins right here. Wisdom is a matter of the heart.